Hello and welcome to Connor's Basement, the podcast about the music of Connor Oberst and Bright Eyes. It has been a minute. Not to spend too much time in the intro, because we do have a lot to get to for this episode, especially if you see the runtime. Yeesh! Today we're going to be going over I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning, one of the most storied albums in the indie genre, and of course, the Bright Eyes discography. This came out in 2005 within a double release alongside Digital Ash, Digital Urn, which we did a previous episode about that you should check out. This episode, we wanted to do a special shout out for all of our patrons. It has been a while since we uploaded, so we wanted to thank everyone that's continued to support us or those that supported us during the time that we hadn't uploaded anything. So, big thank you to Julia, Craig, Steven, Eric, Mom, Goldie, and Lad. You guys are rock stars. Thank you so, so much for supporting us. But with that being said, hold on a couple seconds and, well, you'll hear my voice yet again. Oh, hold on. Whoa. Watch your step. Yeah, hold on. Let me get the broom. I see some cobwebs up in the corner. Damn, how long has it been? I didn't think we were gone that long.
It's kind of funny. Like, you would think that after we're done squatting, we leave, we come back. Like, wouldn't the Obersts want to, like, keep the place clean a little bit? Like, are we responsible for the building that we squat in? Like, feels very unprofessional.
Yeah, and I think there's a pack of raccoons that I saw. But, you know, maybe we could befriend them. I wouldn't mind, like, a pet to have here.
No, I feel like the podcast could use a mascot too. So maybe like a horde of raccoons is a good enough podcast mascot, I think.
Have you ever seen that video where that old guy feeds like 30 raccoons hot dogs?
It's great. I feel like I know somebody who does that.
Everybody listening right now should stop listening and please. Please look up Old Man Feeds Raccoons Hot Dogs on YouTube. It's fantastic.
it sounds both horrifying and wholesome all at the same time.
So, after you're done watching that YouTube video, we should probably discuss the album. You know what I'm saying? The Bright Eyes album. For better or for worse, whether you're a super fan or not, like, the Bright Eyes album.
I would agree. I would say, like, this is the one where if you asked, you know, your normie off the street who's never stepped foot in Connor Oberst's basement, and you said, hey, name me a Bright Eyes song, and the first thing they said is, what the fuck are you talking about? If that's not the case, okay? So they know about Bright Eyes, right? Then, assuming they know about Bright Eyes, you would then probably get a single off of this album, or at least one of the songs off of this album.
Yeah. And you know, we talked about it before, Digital Ash, this is the album that's gotten the most critical acclaim and everything like that. Obviously high on the charts, number two, with Digital Ash being number three, both behind Crunk Juice by Lil Jon and the East Side Boys. That's my favorite trivia fact now.
Yep.
First Day of My Life was the number one single. Take It Easy, Love Nothing was number two back in like 2005 when these came out. So, you know, this is definitely it's the Bright Eyes album. It is the first, I mean, this and Digital Ash were the first to like really feature Nate, or as I called him, Nader Tot, as a full-time member of the band. But I guess overall, like, what are your thoughts on the album? I mentioned this specifically because I want to talk about my thoughts on the album.
I think you're gonna end up having way more to say about this album than I'm going to, because while I do like this album quite a lot, and it is sort of like the gateway drug that I would give people to say like, hey, you should check this band out, you should check this guy out, he's pretty good, I feel like this, for better or worse, is maybe the simplest Bright Eyes album. Mm-hmm. And I say that as not an insult. I think a lot of people sometimes hear simple and they think like stupid or
lacking invention or creativity
Which I don't think this is as creative as some of their other albums, most of their other albums, but I don't think that means that this is like, you know, corporate, a corporate algorithmically created album. Nothing like that.
It's an NPR album.
Oh, dude, that's brilliant. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's an NPR album. I agree with you. I do really like the album. And I think before going and doing the deep dive, I felt less passionately about the album. After the deep dive, I was like, you know what? Like, this is better than I give it credit for. And believe me, I still gave it a ton of credit. But I came up with a mathematical formula. I'm still working on it. It's still in the beginning stages. It's called SPA, or slaps per album. So I legitimately wrote it out with parentheses and notation and all of that.
Okay.
So what you do is you take each song and multiply it by an intensity, like a coefficient between 0 and 1. If a song is like even better than that, you can give it a 1.1. So let's take a song. Let's take At the Bottom of Everything, right?
Okay.
You would take that song and you'd give it a score between 0 and 1.1. For me, I gave it like I gave it a 0.8, right? So okay. It's pretty high. That's like an 8 out of 10. Slaps or an 8 out of 11. Slaps pretty hard, right? And then you do that and you add it up for every single track on the album, divide it by the number of tracks and multiply by 100. And there you go. I mean, it's just averaging. It's literally all it is an average of the scores you'd give a song. But what makes it unique is, I think if there's a song you generally skip, you have to give it a 0.
Right, right.
You can't give it like some pity points. If it's like, oh, I'm going through the album, I might skip this, that song's a 0. So yeah, it's called Slaps Per Album. I'm Wide Awake had one of my lower scores at a 5.1. And surprisingly, People's Key had my highest SPA score at a 6.3. Fevers and Mirrors was 6.2. Mathematicians in our listener base, contact me for the SPA score.
Maybe there needs to be like a quality control too, of like, maybe you need to average your SPA score for an album. Like, you need to do the score at least like 5 times before you start like settling down on a number.
Oh,
so maybe
true.
Like,
yeah,
like once a month, days, like really weeks. Dig into that album and then do a SPA score.
I like that. Yeah. So, try it out. See how you feel. So anyway, I really don't know why I had to explain that entire thing, but I do enjoy I'm Wide Awake It's Morning, right? Like compared to other albums, it has a much higher SPA score. but overall, I feel like it's, I'm not as big of a country fan. So I feel like, so some of those songs, some of the folkier songs, lyrically, I love them and I can dig into them, but it's less of a, I don't know, I get less out of it musically, I guess I'd say, which I feel scared saying that. I feel like we're going to get a lot of backlash.
I don't know. I feel like as we've sort of explored with our like mingles with singles, I think the fact that we have such a we have a pretty varied taste in music, and I feel like for all that we say, like, oh, we don't necessarily, we're not super country fans, and so like the folkier side of this album is not going to really, you know, resonate too much with us. I think we'll be forgiven just because it's, you know, we make up for that in exploring other parts of the album. As well as, like, as you're saying, I think that digging into the lyrics, we can definitely get more into it, even if we maybe don't as much like the sonic side of things.
Yeah, totally agree with you there. But I guess maybe that then is a good segue to say, hey, Chris, Jesse, why don't you start talking about the album and stop talking about stupid scores and your stupid opinion Like, let's talk about our other stupid opinions about about the story of the album and all of that. I did write down a quick thing in terms of like what Connor had to say. I mentioned some of this in relation to Digital Ash, but you know, he said that there was some overlap in terms of what he's talking about and singing about since he created them around the same time. But I thought this was interesting. I think to me, Wide Awake is not necessarily a hopeful record, but more of a rallying, take responsibility for the world around you kind of thing. He says some other stuff. It says it's just the idea of really stepping forward and embracing everything around you. So that's what Connor himself had to say. So basically, everything he said is wrong, and we are the arbiters of what he actually said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that's about right. I feel like as the preeminent scholars of everything Connor Oberst, we can rewrite history.
Yeah. But I think ultimately, though, what he said, he gets his point across, right? Like, in terms of what he says and in terms of, I mean, my reading of the album, at least, he does a good job of getting that point across in terms of that. I mean, we'll talk a little bit about the context of the album, right? Living in New York, Iraq War, post 9/11, all that kind of stuff. And you definitely hear those feelings that Connor was expressing in that little interview quote come out all across the album for sure.
Yeah, I agree. And I did I did find it interesting how he explicitly said that it wasn't like, or at least his intention wasn't to go, or their intention, I should say, wasn't to go for a sense of hope. But I will stick to my guns and say that a lot of Bright Eyes albums do have that sense of hope. They always have that silver lining, as dark as a lot of these albums get. And I don't think that At the Bottom of Everything is an exception. But I do respect the fact that, you know, you do have to sometimes take in authorial intent when you actually hear about an artist saying, this was our intention about XYZ. Like, you can't, completely discredit that.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with you there. Well, just another quick note before we get into At the Bottom of Everything. I know we'll generally talk about themes and things like that before we're going into the album. Really, the two things I want to bring out are symbols, rather, but that play between morning and night, and then also with like weather, like rain, those kinds of things, I think are repeated symbols that we'll hear. And those are things that I was conscious of specifically trying to suss out. Is there a commonality when he says rain, when he says morning? Does that relate explicitly to a specific like feeling or something like that? So that was my kind of idea as I went through it, was can I connect all of these different references? And maybe I did so a little haphazardly. We'll see. I'll try to argue my case. I don't know if you had any like overall things you wanted to bring out before we get into the nitty gritty.
No. I think we're probably going to have similar notes as far as that goes. There is a lot of heavy like symbolism. There's a lot of repetition of the things that you just said, of like weather, light, darkness, water again in this album. But we can dig into those as we explore each track.
Yeah, cool. So I guess with that being said, Jesse, shall we meet everyone here at the bottom of everything?
Yeah, let's plunge into the deep blue sea.
So the story, of course, every Bright Eyes album starts with some kind of interstitial or something to kind of introduce the album. This one specifically is Connor kind of, I always imagine, drinking whiskey.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way, or is that just me?
Okay, so I picture one of two things. It's either like Connor at the bar, whiskey in hand, completely ad-libbing a story for somebody's entertainment and just spinning the yarn. Or I'm just imagining like him with like a bottle of water, sitting on like a three-legged stool in like a recording studio with like just plain concrete everywhere, and just like a camera and then like the boom mic, but you can see the boom mic in the shot.
Okay.
Am I painting enough of a picture?
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, if I want to get specific with it, I see like a very black room.
Okay.
And it's Connor on like a bar stool with just the only light is light that's shining on another bar stool that has his whiskey on it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So like, it's very dark and like, I don't know. That's what I've always seen ever since I was a young lad listening to, listening to this. But so for the story itself, I think it's kind of like an equalizing story, right? So it's like this woman, she's very cosmopolitan. That was the word that I came up with. She's on an airplane to see her fiance, right? So there's already some wealth, some money that's in there. And then she's reading this magazine about third world countries. And it's this kind of duality of being able to sit back in your fancy airboat and read about these problems in other countries and just kind of feel bored and feel despondent, but not because of what you're reading in the article, just because of that kind of like ennui, I guess I'd say. So I think he paints a pretty stark picture of this woman, but then ultimately how we all fall to the same depths. We all end up in the same place of, I don't know, this could never happen to me, but then all of a sudden you're in a plane and it's going down and you're getting ready to die.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I had not thought of it that way. And actually your quote that you brought up from Connor saying something along the lines of, it's an album about like really taking on responsibility and accepting like the whole of everything, if I'm getting that right.
Yeah.
And it is really interesting that the story starts with a disconnection, that it starts with a woman flying to meet her fiance. So it's two people are about to get married and they're like in two different parts of the world, it seems.
Yeah.
Then you've got the woman reading the magazine article and can't connect with this other world, like you're saying, like that despondence of like, you know, it's not happening to me. It's really hard to care about something that's not directly affecting my life. And then it's the fellow passenger next to her who is completely also checked out. And it's only in that moment of crisis, in that impending doom, that the man with the Bloody Mary is actually going to reach out and attempt to do something to make some sort of connection there.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's another interesting piece that I didn't necessarily like focus on too, is that like connection and disconnection as well. Yeah, I think it's also interesting to start off your album with a plane crash, especially again the wake of 9/11 and everything. I mean, it's hard not to draw a connection there, that it's specifically a plane crash of all things that he's gonna tell a story about. But the song itself, I think, is a relatively typical Connor standard. You know, we do live in a society. And so like, I think there are specific lyrics you can pull out, but overall, like that's what's happening. I think unsurprisingly, probably the line that pulls me out the most is the, duality of like, while my mother waters plants, my father loads his gun. So the way his mother is nurturing versus violence maybe being a way to find salvation. And I think you could also think of that of two ways of how to deal with conflict of, should we just get our guns and go overseas, or is there a different way? Is there some kind of like nurturing or diplomatic way possibly of solving things? But this is the first time too, I think, you start to get that symbol of water and rain, because I'm thinking of it, rain watering plants. And I started to think of it maybe in like Bowl of Oranges style, right? Like, your eyes must do some raining if you're ever going to grow, right? So you have to shed these tears. You have to have these negative things happen sometimes to ultimately grow.
Yeah, I don't think I could have said it any better. I think that this is, I don't know, maybe just doing the podcast has made it very apparent that, like, we're starting to see patterns in the albums that I had not noticed before. I had to, like, actually articulate my thoughts about it. But it seems like this is sort of a thesis statement for the rest of the album, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, as you say, that line pretty much packs in a lot of stuff that the rest of the album is going to go over. That tension between life and death, the presence of water, and as you say, to an extent, weather, like watering plants connected to raining, that I think disconnect that people have, that relationships have. You know, there's that interesting line, like, that we have to deny we have a soul, that we, like, the reference to your social security number, and then enter the endless race for property and privilege. And I think, like, that is maybe a big source of this disconnect, of this system that we're all trapped in that makes it so that we can't really connect with other people. And then the song ends, I think, interestingly, with this, the imagery of swimming again, with the city buses swimming past. And to me, that implies that this water imagery is, the city is at the bottom of everything. Like, if you get down to the bottom of everything, right, here we are in the city. And then being happy that you're no one, which I think is echoed later in People's Key, eventually when we get there, being happy that the wave has crested, that you don't have to be an exception, that you don't have to somehow be a hero that saves the day and sweeps up the mess. And again, there's water imagery there, so maybe Connor has a water thing going on.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a freedom, right, in realizing that you are one of many, of the insignificance of yourself can create a significance in your own life. You know what I mean? That you can try to do as much as you can, but there's no pressure because nobody's keeping score at the end of it, that kind of thing. I did have one other line that I wanted to bring up, just because, like I said, in terms of, like, light and morning and night kind of maybe being symbols. So, into the caverns of tomorrow with just our flashlights and our love, we must plunge. And so I was thinking about it in the sense of maybe when everything else is dark around you, when everything else is kind of falling apart, you have to find your own path. You have to find a way to generate that light yourself. You know, you don't necessarily know that morning is not a sure thing sometimes, you know, that's not a guarantee. So you might have to traverse the dark. And if you're going to do that, you have to make do with whatever light that you can produce. And, you know, why not throw love in there as well? Because you need some of that connection, some of that togetherness, as well, to kind of get through and find your way. But yeah, though, that was the only other line that I specifically wanted to pull out for this song.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I don't really have much else to say about the song either, but I think we did all that we can do to sort of, like, unpack that story and this song. And I think with the rest of the album, we'll have more of a context for that song and these images that we see here in this first one.
Yeah, for sure. Wait, hold on. Where are we?
Hang on. I'm checking my map. I'm going to google.org, and I'm going to mapping.google.org.
Yeah. And what time is it?
Now. It's now.
Oh.
And there's, I have no signal.
So are you saying that we are nowhere and it's now?
We are nowhere and it's now.
Oh boy. Well, another kind of song on this album that has gotten some mainstream play, I think it appears in Knocked Up of all movies, right?
Yeah.
Seth Rogen, big Bright Eyes guy. Right. I wouldn't be surprised, actually. But yeah, this is truly, like, a beautiful, beautiful song. I think there's so many different quotables in here. I don't have too much overall to say, mainly just like one specific reference that'll tease out in a second. But I think overall in the beginning, kind of this fighting through self-destructive behaviors, through some cognitive dissonance, you know, those questions of, well, if you hate the taste of wine, then why do you use it, right? And there's an answer to that question. It's not about the taste, it's about the effect. You know, why are you scared to dream of God if it's salvation that you want? Those kinds of things that kind of fighting through. But I've always assumed that he's talking to another person, but reading through it, I was curious if maybe he is just asking himself these questions, this kind of like reflective journey, and just kind of getting stuck in his own head, trying to work through those thoughts and feelings.
Yeah, I think maybe the tracks up until Lua are more reflective, and Lua would then make the flip from like, these are thoughts in my head, to I'm directing these at somebody. Just because this does seem, at least from the narrative standpoint, more personal. And this is kind of, these are the thoughts I would imagine somebody having with a big life change of like, you're between places, you're going from an old way of life to maybe a new way of life. And it's everything is kind of up in the air and nothing has settled. Kind of like with the last song being trapped in a cavern. You can only really see the past and forward is dark. And you only have what little sources of light that you can muster up. And so to me, I get this is more of a rumination than anything. And yeah, I think maybe he's talking to himself when he's saying, like, if you hate the taste of wine, why do you drink it till you're blind? Like, maybe it's self-reflection. Like,
yeah,
why am I doing this to myself? What is the what is that? Oh, holy fools was the split that Bright Eyes did with Sun Ambulance.
Sun Ambulance, yeah.
And it's what was it? Oh, if I could talk to myself like I was someone else, maybe I wouldn't act like such an asshole all the time. Right? Like, so maybe he's talking to himself now and trying to take some like self-advice.
Yeah, I definitely. And especially, too, given the context of like the God line and, you know, Connor's feelings on religion and that kind of thing, too. I did want to highlight, not that I think it changes anything about the reading of the song, but I always find this interesting. So all day it seems we've been in between a past and future town. In the actual lyric book, it says past and present town.
Huh.
Which, again, it's like an interesting thing. When I thought about it, it's like, I don't think it like radically changes. Oh my God, this is it. This was the key. I've unlocked it. But I, you know, always curious whenever, you know, kind of making those changes between what's written and what's ultimately sung, which of course he does all the time. If you've seen him live, if you've been lucky enough to do that. But the one thing that I think is also very important to highlight in the song is the reference to the yellow bird, which of course will find its way back, I think, intentionally towards the end of the track, to end of the album, after its first appearance being at the beginning of the album. So, not to get too much into Poison Oak, because that's its own song, I want to talk about it there, but I know that there's some debate whether does the yellow bird represent something hopeful, or is it the canary in a coal mine type metaphor of watching something to avoid some kind of danger. So I think that in this sense, I'm leaning more towards the canary metaphor because of the context of Poison Oak and his friend maybe saying like, hey, you've seen what living your life under the influence can do. Don't forget your yellow bird. And I think that can be both heart-wrenching of thinking about this other person, but also a little hopeful of, you know, they've made these mistakes, I've learned from them, I've made peace with that kind of thing. But you know, as Connor said, it's not meant to be a hopeful album. So,
yeah, yeah, I think that's an interesting interpretation. And while not positive, I think it does leave room for some sort of growth, right? Like some sort of, you know, if you remember that Yellow Bird, maybe the worst can be avoided. But yeah, certainly more grim than the upbeat, even though it's like got a melancholy feel to it. It's certainly not grim and dour.
It's like, it's not a good thing what happened to this other person, but in a sense, it's like being able to use their experience as a guiding star. And it's like a way of keeping them alive still, right? Because I was trying to find a way, like, there's not a hopeful way to talk about how someone has fallen apart due to addiction.
No.
But at the same time, I think in thinking of it, it's like keeping their spirit alive as like a, I still remember you kind of thing. And that's, I think, where the hopeful piece comes in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good distinction to make. And I'm glad that you clarified there. I mean, personally, I don't have much else to go on here. I'm curious, as a passing thought, if the reference to his favorite neon sign, if he's talking about St. Dimna's.
Maybe, actually, yeah. All right, New York City and all that. I would not be surprised if that may be it. And apparently it's back. Did you hear that?
Oh, no, I didn't hear that. I remember I had gone once and sort of basked in the glory of it, only to be heartbroken a couple of months later to find that it, like, closed down. But I'm surprised now of all times it's back.
Yeah, I saw it on the shout-out O-Boards. What up? Saw it on the subreddit. But yeah, so, you know, next time we'll have to make the trip.
Do a Connor's Basement meetup at St. Dimna's.
Yeah, we can, I don't know, maybe they have karaoke and we can sing like an old soul song or something like that.
Oh, we could sing Laura Lauren and then we can all sing along at the end.
That was my transition.
I trampled right over it. I don't give a shit. I don't give a right shit. Over it.
So despite the fact that you so rudely ruined my beautiful transition... so Old Soul Song for me is one of my top songs on the album. And I think it's mostly because of that energy that he brings at the end. That's just like, that hits home as one of those classic Connor Bright Eyes kind of, tracks. But overall, I think the song deals with maybe some of the disappointment or frustration with protests and revolution. You know, like you have all these grand ideas and grand plans of like, yeah, we're going to go out, we're going to get past the barricades and we're going to let them know how we feel, what we think. But ultimately, things don't always end up changing, you know, and that's disheartening for sure. After that, I mean, one of the things that I specifically want to highlight, though, because it has been one of those lyrics that I've been chewed on for so long. Was on the way home, held your camera like a Bible, wishing so bad that it held some kind of truth. And I think that has that air of disappointment in it, that how you're wishing that you could take a photo of this monumental, we did it, you know, change happened, and just hoping that when you develop the photos, that ultimately that's the truth that comes out of it.
Oh, yeah, I could totally see that. And I don't think the timeline matches up. I didn't do my research for this particular thing, but I couldn't help but think of like Occupy Wall Street of like, you know, a lot of people who were like very young and doing something that they thought was good and probably is good, but it's only going to like history books are going to be the ones to decide that. And imagine being part of that protest, taking pictures and praying that like one of these will be in a history textbook as like a turning point in history. And we were there for that. And we made that happen. And look at this photo that we took that is now emblematic of this important change. And I can't help but feel like that desperation is like holding your camera like a Bible.
Yeah, I think that is a much better way to put it. I did look it up while you were talking. Occupy Wall Street was 2011, but I mean, gotcha. Not that that was the only, you know, protest, you know, I'm sure were definitely plenty of others that Connor even specifically attended because, you know, he's always been very socially, politically active for a while. Yeah. For me, like I said, too, the end of the song, the energy is just fantastic. And I love that comparison of nature to a TV rather than the other way around. Yeah, so I was thinking about it in terms of like media bias and things like that. Like the only way we're seeing the rest of the world is through TVs, which ultimately are reproductions of whatever it is you're seeing, but they can be manufactured and skewed unless you are being hyper vigilant. Manufactured consent and all of that. Look into it. It's a fun little read. I don't know, maybe perhaps that also ties in with the camera line a little bit of about like maybe that kind of the camera was meant to photograph this reproduction of the truth, but ultimately it also ends up getting used to skew because you end up trusting it and taking it as gospel. But unfortunately, there are bad faith, bad actors with bad habits. some sad singers, you know, they just play tragic. that ultimately are attempting to like skew what's true for their own gain.
Yeah, yeah. I think that any tool can be a weapon, right? And if put in the wrong hands, it becomes something very dangerous. And as you're saying, you can shift any narrative just by framing it a certain way. I also can't help but think that this is also, I don't know, some sort of until smartphones really became a thing and like actually good cameras on phones were a thing. I could see this kind of being an analogy of like, we're going to an event and instead of actually being there and present and interacting with people in the moment, we're just doing the, you know, early 2000s equivalent of using a selfie stick and not really being there because we're too occupied with, you know, taking that perfect picture to show other people that we were there instead of, you know, returning with a story about how we were really there. Moment of disconnect where like, maybe is it possible that this person was so hell-bent on getting a good photo that they weren't actually present at the event that they were physically there for?
Huh. Yeah, maybe all along Connor was the first one to point that out. I mean, he does, we do know he loves a good social commentary. So, you know, everyone heard this and subconsciously then jumped on the bandwagon of hating the damn kids with their selfie sticks and their TikToks. I only have one thing that TikToks,
and it's the clock my grandpappy makes, and it still works today.
Jesse, do you have any closing thoughts about this song?
Not really. I think that we've definitely spoken about this before, about how like there is a lot of symbolism going on in this album that I don't know whether is like, there is something way deeper going on and Connor's playing 6D chess with us and we can't keep up, or it's just very simple on the surface symbolism. Like, as you brought up the comparison of comparing a wall of flowers to, sorry, like a hill of flowers with a wall of TVs and not the other way around is very interesting. Like this kind of confusion and weird priority between technology and nature seems interesting. And I don't know whether like there's something deeper going on there or it's just, we hit the nail on the head and it's time to move on. But I think as we go through the album, we're going to get more of those moments where we kind of sit there and scratch our heads and be like, is there something more here? Is there something we're missing? Or did we just get all of it? And it's just like, air quotes, hidden in plain sight.
I think everything that we say means that we've successfully figured everything out. Like, I don't think it's possible for us as just like being the best people that we would have missed something. So,
all right. I'm okay with this. I like this narrative.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't have a clever pun for Lua.
I know a party at some actor's West Side Loft if you want to go.
Hasta luego.
We're keeping it.
All right. Anyway, so keeping with maybe this idea of maybe could be a lot more hidden, I don't think that there's too much to dig into with this song. Like, obviously it fits thematically, but I don't think that there's a specific thread in the song that we need to try to pull through the entire rest of it. It is beautifully written, but I don't think it is, like, it's hidden, but a careful eye, it's clear what he's saying, that kind of thing, right? Like, the mirror imaging of drugs and a drug addiction with maybe how a relationship could make you feel as well. I think ultimately drugs end up being the focal point. But, you know, a lot of the similarities maybe of First Day of My Life as well, but a darker side of it, of like that, the pang, the lust, the I need this. And I think no more than the line that you and I were talking about with Nikki a couple of days ago, of you just keep going to the bathroom, always say you'll be right back. It takes one to know one, kid. I think you got it bad, which is a clever way to talk about going to the bathroom to use cocaine and saying, hey, I know what's going on. But I think it's also a way that he's saying, like, I don't know, if you're nervous on a date, you might go to the bathroom, take a couple of breaths, maybe fix your hair. Like, I'm okay. It's fine. I'm doing fine. I'm doing okay. So there is that mirror between the two.
Yeah, I totally see that. And I think that what's curious about this song is that connection between this and First Day of My Life, as far as it being a darker reflection of a love song, because in a way that's what it is, but maybe it's a more frank look at what a mutually toxic relationship is. Like, it doesn't seem like one party is abusing another in this relationship. It just seems like two people who probably should not be together enabling each other are together and enabling each other, which is quite different from what we've heard previously, which, for the most part, every time we've heard a toxic relationship in a Bright Eyes song, there's usually some party that is, there's a power imbalance, that somebody is in charge of the relationship and the other person is suffering. And this one just kind of feels like two people that, you know, are bringing out the worst in each other. And even if it seems kind of supportive, it's ultimately really dangerous. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
No, I 100% agree with that for sure. I think that makes a lot of sense. Of, like you said, they're bringing out the worst in one another. Nighttime, it's a lot of fun because you get to stay under the influence. But once the buzz wears off and the morning comes, and you're with each other, those same feelings are not there because it's a relationship that seems centered around the nightlife, which, depending on how it goes, you know, can be all right, but, you know, moderation and all that kind of stuff. So I think, yeah, that's the issue between him and this kind of pseudo love interest, is that when the morning comes, those feelings are not the same, which, so ultimately the relationship seems doomed.
Which is, it's just kind of funny that, like, it's that line of logic that is the song that, you know, is only separated by another one as far as, like, maybe the quintessential Bright Eyes love song. And it's funny that like the two singles from this album are like this, and then also First Day of My Life. It's kind of a funny. I don't know what to make of that.
No, definitely. I didn't even think of that. The fact that those two are the singles, and there are two very different sides of a similar coin. Yeah.
And like, I mean, they sound like they belong on the same album, but like, if you just read the lyrics of these two, I don't think you'd be able to be, wait, both of these are on the same record? What are you talking about? Hold on.
Imagine Lua with Digital Ash production.
Oh, interesting. I was ready for you to say, imagine Lua with Fevers and Mirrors production.
Oh, that'd be interesting too. I was just thinking because of drugs. Oh,
yeah, you know, honestly, fair.
Yeah. Oh, that would be okay. You know, someone take that on. The reimagining of Lua Digital Ash edition. Well, that would actually be really sick.
It would. I'm actually curious. Like, do you think that we could then go back? I'm not saying we should do this right now, but I'm curious if we went back and looked at Digital Ash. Do you think there's a song that belongs on this album? And like, there's a weird thing that if you like swap these two songs and just look at the lyrics, that they would be right at home in the other album.
It's like a puzzle piece,
right?
You just gotta. I don't know. Yeah, that'd be interesting to take a look at for sure.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. We're cracking the code. We're unlocking the secrets of Connor Oberst and his music. We're on to you, Connor. You can't hide.
It's the code that we've always known but could never understand.
It's the arc of time, the time code.
Do you have anything else to say about Lua?
I don't. I was thinking though, maybe we could catch a subway. I don't know. There's some weird guy I know who always calls them trains underwater, which like, what are you from, an alien from outer space?
It's almost like Connor was like coming from the Midwest, and he's like, I ain't never heard of one of these underground trains. You telling me that they go underwater? As the title indicates, we've got another big water imagery song happening.
Mm-hmm.
And not only is, you know, as we jokingly said before, like, this is a reference to a subway, but it's also, it opens with Connor talking about somebody in a very poetic way of being born in a raindrop. And to me, that always kind of, and maybe just because I spent so much time in New York City, it felt like that expression, a drop in the bucket, of like being one of many, and especially in such a big city like New York City, where you are really anonymous in a crowd,
mm-hmm.
that you do sort of vanish in that crowd in many ways. And I guess we're going back to like water as both life and death at the same time, sort of like how we talked about in Fevers and Mirrors. And I don't know, did anything immediately jump out at you from this album? Sorry, from this song?
Well, I think overall, it seems like the song was, I don't know, some kind of warning or like advice to a friend or maybe even like the listener, like centering around connection and what happens when that is gone. Like Connor is trying to find this other person, and he needs to try to meet them. He's trying to like just reach out and connect via the subway, like whatever, you know, that just happens to be the mode of transit there. But again, like he says it in a way that's, it's intentional, right? You could call it the subway, but he's calling it a train underwater. But you know, just not even like romantically need to connect or whatever, just like as humans, as people. I did also see like the weather theme come up. I was wondering if maybe it wasn't a person, but maybe a feeling, like you, like in terms of like you were born inside of a raindrop, like how emotions can turn into tears when they build up, just like rain from a cloud, you know, they get dense and heavy. I'm no meteorologist, so I can't remember too much from high school or whatever we talked about precipitation, but basically that, you know, eventually the rain starts to fall. Like, I don't know, maybe it is just like the welling up of emotions that eventually get too much and kind of burst.
Yeah, yeah. I could see it being maybe a song to maybe inspiration, like a song, a modern song to amuse, maybe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not amuse, a space muse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm hunting. There's that line. I was a camera until I went blind, and now I'm riding all over this island looking for something to open my eyes. Like, I'm hunting for that spark that's going to inspire me again. I did want to bring up that line that definitely encapsulates what we're talking about when we're talking about the weather imagery in this album. So you said the line, wait out the weather that howls in my brain, because it seems that it's always changing, the wind's indecision, the sorrowful rain. Now, let me just, I'm gonna dust off my my liberal arts major here.
Oh, and, hell yeah.
There's a thing in art called the pathetic fallacy. And this is basically when an artist will attribute human emotions and things going on in a story to natural phenomena. So, like, if a character is, like, really down in the dumps, typically it's going to be a cloudy day. Or,
okay,
you know, so happy I'm on cloud nine. It's a bright, shiny, beautiful day. It's like the artist is matching the human mood of the scene with something natural that doesn't feel anything. Like, obviously, you can be happy on a cloudy day and you can be sad on a sunny day.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that's what Connor is doing here. And he's sort of laying out like a map key of, like, is it possible that when he's talking about rain and water, it's supposed to talk about, we're supposed to get sorrow from that. And if there is wind present in a song, it's supposed to indicate that there's some sort of indecision or hesitation.
Oh, interesting.
So, like, I'm curious if, I don't know how often wind actually comes up in this album, but I'm curious if we see it again, if it will be something that's supposed to indicate to us that there's a fork in the road, that there's some sort of decision to be made, and that there's that, like, decision paralysis of, I don't know where to go next.
Very curious. Huh. Yeah, nice degree you got there, Jesse. It's come in handy, I see.
Yeah, it's really good for getting those jobs that, like, let me mop floors and scrub toilets. It's really good. Also, that's a joke. I respect anybody who does janitorial work. You make the world go round, and I think that we should get rid of that stereotype.
Oh, communism. Why should a doctor make as much as a janitor? Anyway. So I wanted to bring out one more thing, which is something you lightly touched on. I was a postcard. I was a record. I was a camera until I went blind. So I thought back to the postcard reminded me of You Will, or maybe even Curious Girl, where, you know, like, for You Will, obviously there's travel. I don't know if he ever mentioned specifically a postcard, but, like, someone that you come back to all the time, you know, the geography of their bodies, go explore those other women, like, but ultimately you come back to this one person. But, you know, Curious Girl has an explicit reference to writing a postcard to Ruba, who's going to read it. Then the record, I was thinking about maybe a song to pass the time in reference to his art, or woke up with the song in my head this morning in reference to an ex. And then the camera again comes up from, we've seen it in Old Soul Song. We'll see it again in Road to Joy. But yeah, so I don't know. Like, so I guess overall, I'm wondering if these are, like, stages of Connor. Like, the postcard, he was gone and away. He needed to try to connect. Some sort of reference to maybe an ex, maybe a specific ex, with woke up in the song in my head this morning, or even not the person, but, like, the memories, right? That, because we were talking about that song of, like, or that day on repeat. And finally, with another camera reference, maybe he's lost some sense of self. Maybe he feels disconnected between what he believed to be the truth and what he's actually seeing, you know, that he can't trust this camera. I don't know. I found the references maybe interesting, although my string I'm trying to pull through them is tenuous at best.
And if I can help you, because I think that I think you have a really strong point, and maybe one thing that might help it even further is that maybe the reference to like being a postcard record and camera is sort of referencing Connor as an artist.
Hmm.
And like maybe he's losing himself for his persona.
Interesting.
It's really
yeah.
interesting that he's expressing this through yet another record that is, you know, we've talked about on previous episodes about like that tension between, you know, the obvious human being Connor and then the person that will only ever know. I mean, I doubt we'll ever meet the guy, but the only way that we know Connor,
you don't have his number? He must have just gave it to me, my bad.
Wait, real talk, tangent. I knew somebody who's like, oh yeah, I have Connor Oberst's phone number, and then like showed me the contact, and I was like, oh, I kind of just want that number to have in my phone, but it feels really creepy to have that without yeah. his consent. So I'm like, at least I have the fun story of like, oh, I could have had Connor Oberst's number. But
yeah, because then you lose the fun of having to ask him out and everything, you know?
Oh, exactly. I don't get to treasure the dirty napkin he wrote his number on for the rest of my life, you know?
Anyway.
Anyway, I was just saying like that tension between who he is as a person and then who we know him as through his art is, you know, I can see that being something that can fuck with you. That you don't really know, am I becoming the thing that I projected myself as? And can I be sure that's really me? And so maybe I need to run away to New York and just, you know, mess around and explore and find that spark that reminds me of who I really am.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll line him up. You keep knocking him down.
we make a hell of a duo.
Yeah. Honestly, it kind of reminds me of when we first locked eyes. I mean, some would say that could have been really the first day of my life.
You don't see it. I'm holding up a card that says 10.
Oh, I was going to say awkward silence. I must have ruined it. I had to shoot my shot, but yeah. Oh, so I mean, what is there to say about this song that like hasn't already been said? You know, it's just a little sweet little song, you know, like love it or hate it. Like it is the most popular Bright Eyes song for a reason, right? Like it is objectively a very good, well-written song. I tried to rationalize it this way. It's Connor at his most earnest describing probably the most universal feeling in the world, right? Like, so you have such a good writer, someone who's so tapped into being able to put feelings into words, earnestly describing this universal feeling of love. Like, yeah, okay, it was gonna frickin' work. Of course it was.
Oh yeah, 100%. And I think I definitely said it this episode, and I know we've made jokes about it on previous episodes, but like I could see why somebody could hear this song and think that it was like, oh yeah, some producer in the shroud of cigar smoke in the boardroom was like, yes, this will work perfectly. We're gonna make millions off of this kid. But because as you say, it's just, I think it's just heart on the sleeve. And I think when you have someone, as you say, like this talented, writing about something that's very easy to hook listeners in with, you come up with something pretty timeless, I think.
Yeah. Toxic and timeless. Not toxic, of course.
Of course.
For our less seasoned listeners, that is a reference to the song Previous.
If so you're just joining us.
Yeah, right. If you haven't read all the lyrics,
you downloaded.
So I mean, the one thing that I did want to maybe mention again was the take it easy, love nothing connection between spreading out the blankets on the beach, that weatherman was a liar, he said it'd be raining. That is the line from Take It Easy. And now in First Day of My Life, I went out in the rain, settle everything changed, they're spreading blankets on the beach. So I mean, I think now at this point, I think it's a perception change, perhaps, that despite how you might feel, despite anxiety, fear, it feels like it is, there's a rain cloud over you, just taking that step. You wait out the weather that howls in your brain, and there's something quite nice. There's some sunshine potentially waiting for you at the other end.
I'm curious. If we're going to make a one-to-one connection between this song and Take It Easy, like, is this an alternate perception of, like, is this like an alternate reality of what each other song is playing with? Is it of a side of the story that ignores the other side? Because I think it's interesting that, like, the I was born in the right in the doorway. Is that like him leaving after she left the note on the cartoon cat pad? And oh, like, we're not, I was born right in the doorway. You could read that as like, as soon as I stepped into the room and saw you, like, that's really where my life began. Or is it like, this is, you know, post sex, she left with the note saying that we're really nothing, and the afterglow hasn't worn off enough for you to realize, like, for that to hit you.
Yeah.
Not to like dampen the good feels of the song, but I'm curious to see if like, there is a possible one-to-one.
I don't think you could dampen the good feels, man. No, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah, that's you know, and I think you could interpret it either way. I think depending on what's going on in your life at that exact moment is how you'll interpret it. When everything is like nice and great, you're like, oh yeah, this is just a sweet love song. But when, you know, someone breaks your heart, you're like, no, there's no way. Love isn't real.
It's just chemicals in your brain. It was never there in the first place. That one's for all you Rick and Morty fans out there.
Well, I think you bring up a good point in that, like, ultimately, yes, perception seems to be at the core of it, but I think you could read it different ways in terms of like what ultimately is his perception changing about. Is it for the better? Is it for the worse? And, you know, of course, it is a Bright Eyes song. You don't have to jump through many hoops to assume the worst in a story.
yeah, that's the fair point. So I just wanted to say one last thing, and this is more of just like a little observation that I always love like pointing out to anybody who I play the song for, which is just like it's a very humble love song. They're like the highest praise that we see is I could go anywhere with you and I'd probably be happy. Like right. there aren't these like big sweeping like majestic comparisons and symbols of love. It's a very realistic, grounded, like maybe it's just enough to say like I'd rather be working for what we have here than waiting for the lottery of that kind of, you know, sweeping romance novel love.
Yeah, like let's build something rather than waiting to be swept off your feet. And I maybe Connor just coming to terms with maybe soulmates aren't really a thing.
Mm.
And I would like to build something with someone that understands me, respects me, versus this kind of wild passion, because maybe the wild passion happens with people from Lua. This is, you know, this is something that's more pure. Oh, I like that. I like that. Good point. Good point. You should do a podcast about Conor Oberst songs. well, I mean, okay, yet another love song. How about we get to another traveling song? We haven't traveled in a minute.
You're just like fucking knocking them out of the park.
Thank you. Thank you.
I can't even keep up this episode. It's wild. All right. So I think what's interesting about this song is that as much as it has that backstory of Connor's experience in New York City, and it seems pretty grounded in that general place in that general time, like as we've said previously, like the very early post 9/11 America / New York City, which clearly was undergoing some changes socially. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is kind of reminding us of the fact that Connor is still a musician and is probably very rarely in one place for a long amount of time. And I'm curious how that's going to color sort of, you know, keeping that in mind, like it definitely changed how I looked at, you know, his relationship with New York City and kind of the general feel that you get from that location throughout this album. You know, was he grounded enough to like get that feel for New York City, or did he stay long enough to like, you know, feel kind of small in a big city? Not like he's a country mouse and this is like the first time he's been to a city, but like, you know, I've been to a couple of cities in the States and a couple of cities abroad, and it's like, there's hardly a comparison. There are a few cities that I could compare to New York for better or worse. and so I'm curious, like, we'll talk about Landlocked Blues, but I don't think it's a coincidence that we go from Traveling Song to Landlocked Blues after being in a coastal city for the first half of the album,
you know? Yeah. Uh-huh. Definitely. I really, for me, this song felt relatively straightforward. I think basically everything you said hits home. Between that and Landlocked Blues, I think there's a little bit of a duality here too, right? Like, I feel Connor might be wishing he could just be a simple country boy singing simple country songs about, you know, traveling and cities at the break of dawn, like wash away the past, wash away these, maybe these feelings of wanting something more, and just kind of reinvent himself, focus on writing this more simple, bland music, you know, that doesn't mean all too much, that he could shut off this other part of his brain. But no matter how hard he tries, he ultimately always gets kind of brought back to his reality. I think what highlights that, right? They're driving and he's talking to his brother. Nothing in the past or future ever will feel like today. You know, like I am loving this. But once they stop moving and they're parking the van, it's back to the same old feelings of anxiety because you are in one place again. So, I mean, like that highlight from Landlocked Blues, just to highlight it real quick, and maybe we can blend these two songs, honestly, but it always feels worse when I stay in one place, right? I think he's kind of expressing that same thing, that when he's on the road, when he's moving, at least then the anxiety shuts away for a little bit because he can focus on the here and now versus getting stuck in his thoughts and his feelings.
Yeah, and I think, do we want to start blending these a little bit? Because I feel like, as you say, I feel like this song is kind of exactly what it says on the tin. Mm-hmm. And we can like kind of flip between them, but...
Yeah, definitely. I only have one other thing for another traveling song as well. So I could just mention it, and then we'll talk about Landlocked Blues.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
All right, so I mean, I just thought it was interesting. This is kind of maybe a little bit of a throwaway point, but how the pop song also distracts from the horrors of everyday life. Again, going back to this, like media, maybe covering up the truth, the media kind of putting this popular culture in your face to try to stop you from paying attention to what's going on behind the scenes. But that's also contrasted by the day in Old Soul Song, the day of the protest, where that is what comes on the radio rather than the pop song that's playing loud, that wakes him from this like nightmare that he's having.
Yeah, and I'm curious if it's like you wake from the nightmare into a waking nightmare of yeah, like, right? You know, I can imagine what it's like, or I can only imagine what it's like for an artist to, you know, give it their best earnest shot and then see, you know, I hate doing this kind of thing because I think that all music is art, and like I would not want to take away from somebody else's, you know, success, or, you know, to say that like, oh, if you like this thing that's on the radio, it's actually garbage and you should feel bad for liking it.
Yeah.
But like, I can imagine what it's like for a smaller music, a smaller musician to fight against the insurmountable foe that is, you know, if a really big record label likes you, they're going to make you a star.
Yeah,
and
right.
How am I supposed to compete with that when like somebody can put out a song that, you know, doesn't have that level of lyrical craftsmanship that somebody like Connor is producing?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair for sure. So, yeah, why don't you give us some landlocked blues, Mister?
All right, so I think that. I'm kind of in two minds about landlocked blues because I like the way that it starts, as far as like you had Lua, where you've got this relationship between two people who are mutually toxic and enabling each other in some pretty bad ways. And this song starts with, if you walk away, I'll walk away. This like, we're going to separate. We're going to go our separate ways, and we're going to make sure that our paths don't cross again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of sounds like two old foes trying to, like, make sure that there's not, you know, mutually assured destruction.
Right, but right.
If you put it in the context of Lua, it almost seems like we need a clean break, and we need to end this. And we can't go back down this path. Is there anything that like kind of jumped out at you in the beginning of like any sort of connections, or are you just looking at this as its own kind of standalone thing?
No, I mean, I ultimately agree. I was looking at it more standalone about like, I kind of saw it more as a slow burn and decline to the relationship too. Like slowly coming to that realization that, hey, this is not going to work out. But ultimately still trying to avoid it. Maybe I wrote down like he's drinking, he's distracting himself, but they know what's going to happen. In the context of Lua though, it could make even more sense because that is the way they connect, is through the drugs, through the partying, through the drinking. So, okay, if I just keep doing this for another couple of weeks, things will kind of get better. Rather than thinking of it in the traditional sense of like, I'm drinking to forget, he's drinking to sustain, maybe a little bit, when we're thinking of it in that sense. So the one thing that I'm curious about, though, is towards the end, which I know you were talking about like the beginning before, towards the end, it seems a little different, right? It seems like almost some piece of advice that's saying, a good woman will pick you apart, but don't walk away. You know, let this happen. Be willing to sacrifice, be willing to be humbled, and you might be rewarded at the end. So I don't know if it's those are conflicting things from the beginning and the end, or if they're two different people, but it sounds like maybe you have some ideas there.
No, interesting. Yeah, I hadn't considered that part, actually, because that line always kind of jumped out at me as like, I'll know that I found somebody who's good for me when I'm being picked apart or when I'm being criticized.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if like, if we're going to talk about the same person that's referenced in Lua, maybe then that's evidence against this being a good woman. Because if they're in agreement and they're not changing their ways, and they're, you know, there is no, as far as we know from that one song, criticism as to how they're living, right? Like, doesn't the song end with like, I wouldn't recommend it, but it is a way to live.
Yeah.
And right. It's like, it's sort of a resignation to the fact that, like, yep, this is our life, which I don't know how much introspection on that kind of lifestyle is going on in that relationship. But then, as you say, it's like, don't walk away. So that almost seems like it's talking about the person that he's originally trying to make this deal with, of like we're walking away at the same time and we're going in different directions. That's interesting. I don't know what to make of that now.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think, too, maybe we're falling into a little bit of a trap of every song has one specific story, one specific narrative, when ultimately it could just be a bunch of similar thoughts kind of thrown together of, you know, maybe this is the slow decline to a relationship, but he's looking at it in two different lights. Or I'm sure there are people that are going to say, like, there's no way this is about the person from Lua. This is the person from First Day of My Life. You know, like, I ultimately, there are going to be those different ways of seeing it and reading it. But I think overall, though, there's still similar messages that are coming out of it in terms of the theme between Another Traveling Song and Landlocked Blues, of this, I think, Connor maybe being kind of, again, upset with the life that he's chosen, in a sense, of always having to move and how difficult it is to be in one place for too long. It made me think of Gentleman's Pack, right? I tried to die young with my true love, ended up a millionaire. Interestingly, too, I thought of Breakfast in Bed, you know, by Dintel with Connor. Yeah. Like, a similar story. Could be the same person, or it could be one. If there are two people, it could be one of, I don't know, could be someone else completely. But I always find, I hope you always find someone to take you home, to put you into bed, kiss your cheek, and check your pulse. Make sure you're still breathing. Put their hand up to your nose. I wish that could be me, but it's just not possible. You know, I maybe could be somewhat related. I think probably came out around similar times, too.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, interesting. I like those comparisons. And also, did we also completely miss the reference to Laura?
Oh,
Like, is this Laura Lawrence?
I mean, and this is why maybe it could be two different people. I don't know. Maybe it is just Laura.
Because it's there was that line about them making love on the living room floor. And then from Laura Lawrence, they're sharing a sleeping bag.
In her sister's apartment. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. But now I feel like we're straying into Charlie Kelly territory, where we've got the cork board.
Yeah, and right.
The bags under our eyes.
Oh, man. I don't know. Yeah, maybe we shouldn't keep belaboring this, like, single point. I mean, ultimately, though, I think we pull out similar things. I can't wait. I'm sure we're going to get a comment that's like, it's very obviously just Laura. You guys are way too into it. Like, yeah, well, screw you. We had to fill up the time. You make your own damn podcast, right? Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't know. It's a very long song, and there is a lot in there. And I think I'm a bit of a detractor of it, because it is very simple, but I think a lot of Connor's writing has been more succinct, which isn't maybe a full criticism, but I think it makes it a little bit harder to keep track of everything that's going on.
Yeah. I think the only time that we've ever been, like, as confused and turned around is You Will, where, like, just the number of like people being, or like just the non specifics of who is talking about who and who is saying what kind of had us turned around. There are just so many overlapping ideas that like mesh together and form like one of those paintings that like you could look very close and you can see all the specific brush strokes in different colors, and it looks like nonsense, but when you pull back, it makes a cohesive picture. I feel like that's kind of what this song is. Like, if you look at it as a whole, it makes a lot more sense than when you start trying to pick at the specifics.
Are you saying that the picture's far too big to look at, kid? That maybe your eyes won't open wide enough?
Yeah. Oh, man. Great segue into into big picture. So,
oh, God. I don't know. Did we want to segue into Poison Oak?
I think I'm ready to. Well, I mean, I would not want to go into some Poison Oak, but I'm ready to head into Poison Oak.
I'm getting conflicting things because on one hand you just said you don't want to go into Poison Oak, but then after that you just said you're ready to go. Like, what's going on here? I'm really confused.
Oh, I don't want to go into Poison Oak. Like, I don't want the leaves to touch my skin.
But you do want to?
All right. I'm going to go out and get some leaves and start rubbing them all over my body, because this is how we proceed now.
If you hate the Poison Oak, why do you want to go into the Poison Oak? I'm pretty sure that was one of the back on We Are Nowhere.
If you're scared of Poison Oak, why do you want to rub it all over your naked body? And if you swear that there is no truth, then who cares?
Anyway. So the first thing I wrote down about this, right? The first lines in my notes say, fucking banger, dude? Exactly like that. Delivered exactly like that. Oh, God. And honestly, it is definitely one of the most like powerful Bright Eyes songs ever, for sure.
Yeah, I think it enters that... It's the top spot of the pantheon of Bright Eyes songs, mm-hmm. that crescendo to Connor screaming.
Yeah, definitely. It is well within its in that pantheon. What a word. Oof. Mr. Englishman over here.
I went to word school.
Oh, yeah. Honestly though, it's gut-wrenching. I think for me is what gives so much credibility to this album, not to discredit the songs that came before, but I feel like, you know, we were talking about before, we're a little maybe lukewarm on some of the music of it, but this is what really, really for me is like, how can you not love this album when you have Poison Oak on it?
Yeah. Considering what the song is about, It slaps. It slaps real hard. But maybe that's unfair because, like, you could maybe say that about every Bright Eyes song that slaps, which is like,
yeah,
weird slap, but I'm here for it.
I mean, I definitely gave this on my on the spa rating for I'm Wide Awake It's Morning. This was a 1.1. Like, it, you know, it hit an extra tier on the scale.
Oh, I would not expect anything less.
Didn't think I'd bring the spa rating back, but you did say slap, so.
Yeah, I was waiting for it, and I can't wait for, I think the title of the podcast should just be Your Equation.
I could put that in there, that's no big deal.
Or in the description, just put long form, like what your equation was and why it turned out to be the number it is.
Oh boy. Well, Poison Oak. As a word, as a symbol in this, I think is in reference to heroin.
Oh, interesting.
So, of course, he says, feel your arms. But also leading the song off with Poison Oak, some boyhood bravery. I think he does a couple of things, right? I think he invokes them being together as children, playing, not caring that much. But I think it also has the meaning of that teenage invincibility, kind of. And like, I'm going to try this thing. I'm going to try this poison oak, this heroin. despite the consequence, and ultimately, you know, the negatives that obviously come with that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I'm not sure if we had pointed this out, but in our chat with Nikki off the podcast, we talked about how in Lua, there was a line that Nikki and I had misinterpreted, that the reference to you're looking skinny like a model with your eyes all painted black and like constantly going to the bathroom, I had thought was a reference to an eating disorder.
Right.
And so, like, I did not get the context of poison oak as, like, a slang for heroin. And so that line, you wrote bad checks just to fill your arm, coupled with, I was young enough, I still believed in war. I thought by arm, they were talking about a gun.
Oh,
like you stole a car, drove towards Mexico. Like I'm expecting like somebody kind of went postal and maybe a little like unhinged, had a weapon and did sketchy things just to get ammo, and being young enough and thinking like, oh, he's doing the right thing. He's like sticking it to the man or like whatever the context for that situation.
Damn,
was.
That's crazy. That's I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but it's just so completely different than like what I had seen too.
Yeah. And now like that being a reference to heroin makes a lot of sense, filling your arm, right? Like, and just like real quick, because I don't want to, I never want to like, I hate gossip in all of its forms. Mm-hmm. I had not thought too much before about who this song might be about. And since Ruminations, I had been under the impression that this might have been about his brother.
Right.
But I also, you know, I don't know the man's life. But just the fact that, like, you know, there's this almost role model character in this song going down a bad path and having this intimate relationship with Connor. I kind of saw this as Connor's brother. As well as that interesting line of, I'm glad you got away, but I'm stuck out here. My clothes are soaking wet from your brother's tears. And if he's talking about his brother, that could be a poetic way of saying, like, my shirt is soaked with my own tears.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if you have any insight on this.
I don't. I mean, I definitely think that the general fan consensus is that it is likely about his brother, but at the same time, like, say same as you, like, I generally try to avoid like the, oh yeah, this is 100%, unless, you know, some of the things on Down in the Weeds, of course, were like direct references that Connor himself has stated.
Right.
This is maybe not that obscured, but don't like to assume or anything like that. I do think, I thought the same thing about your brother's tears, like maybe they could be Connor's. He does have two brothers, so it could also be his other brother as well.
True.
I don't think it's necessarily like cut and dry. I'm sure some people will tell you that, but I don't like to make those assumptions or anything like that of like attributing this specifically to his brother. But going into maybe some of the specific lyrics, I love the line about, so let the poets cry themselves to sleep, and all their cheerful words will turn back into steam. Now, this is where I kind of started really digging into maybe that bowl of oranges, tears, and growth metaphor of, you know, like emotions that produce tears that are turning into his poems and songs. And in terms of letting them turn back into steam, I'm thinking of wet streets and the sunlight and how steam sort of tends to rise from the concrete when that happens. So that's kind of where I started maybe pulling the thread of like rain, sun, like all of these different things of like the weather themes and night and day and that kind of stuff. Because I mean, it is such a beautiful lyric, honestly, and especially if this was his intention behind it too, it's like, wow, like who thinks like this? But the way he delivers it too, with like some disregard, like don't care so much about us silly, sad poets, I think is really interesting too. The one thing, and I'll let you jump in afterwards, but like, because still going off of this, I thought maybe it ties back into his mother watering plants back on at the bottom of everything, because the garden, there's a muddy field where the garden was, because maybe now that garden that his mother was watering plants in is overflown with tears rather than just like that careful nurturing of watering plants and growing something.
So first, I think it's interesting that like, if we're going to compare the, like, let the tearful words turn back into steam to like, you know, it was raining, the sun is out and it's evaporating all of the rain on the sidewalk, then it is sort of like a flip of Train Underwater, where like, instead of the, like, there was rain, there was that sadness, and now this might be like a turning point or realization that you need to start seeing, like, if not the hopeful side of things, then at least like the silver lining. Although I guess that's saying the same thing. I don't know. I'm having a tough time with like, back to the whole, like, I think this is way more on the surface than I'm making it out to be, but I feel
right.
Like there's something really deep going on here.
Is something really deep going on here. That's all I wanted to interject and say. I don't think you're wrong to think that there's layers to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other thing that was interesting with like the muddy field and like an overwatered garden, and like, is that then a flip of at the bottom of everything, where like maybe the father had a point, like there needs to be balance, you know, like to use the gardening metaphor, you still do need to prune and weed a garden. So like, even in tending plants, there is an element of needing to destroy in order to grow.
Right. Yeah, I honestly, now that you're saying that, I think it's helped me think of a more succinct way of what I was saying before. But like, in order to grow, right, going back to Bowl of Oranges, your eyes must do some raining if you're going to grow. But there's a limit to that, right? There's crying, there is cathartic crying, and through growth and through making mistakes and that sort of thing. But then I also wonder if maybe in this, with the emotions being too much, with there being too many tears, that the garden has now become unsalvageable, like the harvest and everything like that, because there was just too much emotion. There was too much. And now we're past the point of some healthy feelings to grow, and it's taken a turn for something much more, you know, much more long lasting and much more permanent.
And that's an interesting parallel to how the song ends, right? Like, you know, I'm not going to turn into this poet that falls apart and, you know, to use that metaphor, like drowns the garden. But then the freedom comes in the form of intoxication, which is something that like in previous songs has been ambivalent, but leaning towards like, you probably shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how, like what we're supposed to take away from that. Like, is that again, another like a balance in all things? Like, there's a time to let your emotions loose in a sad song versus there is a time to, you know, let loose and party and or drink your sorrows away. Can a balance like that be achieved? And
yeah,
how much is this album and Digital Ash a good case for that?
Yeah, definitely. I had some thoughts too, because like you said, it's interesting then to try to fit it with the last verse, which seems like it maybe has, he's trying to find something positive to say, right? Like the yellow bird comes back. It does sound positive, but with the context of everything else, like how could it be? But I guess with the canary metaphor, maybe he's having some kind of that he's having that realization that he can't ruin himself the same way that this person has. So the last lines are that epiphany that he's having, that he's coming through with the breakthrough the same way he always has through his music, when he writes songs to help him reflect and come to terms, you know, his eyes helping him grow, or his eyes raining to help him grow. But at the end of the day, I don't know, old habits die hard. Like he's still coming to the same conclusion, but at the same time, it's mired with that knowledge that he's still under the influence. But, you know, I guess it, the first step on a journey, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly a journey that, like, you know, this won't be the last time that we revisit these concepts. So it's still a struggle that continues. And I'm curious if, like, if you take away the drugs and alcohol, is there like a universality to it? Like, mm-hmm. if you're not, you know, if you don't drink, if you're not hooked on some sort of drugs, some sort of drug, are you hooked on something else? And you could bring that back to like the whole relationship metaphor. Like maybe you do this with people, whether it's right. romantic or just like your normal human relationships.
Normal human relationships. Yes, we have a very normal human relationship.
I enjoy this human music. Man, I am just knocking it out of the park with these Rick and Morty references.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wubba lubba dub dub.
All right, we're podcast over. We're not even talking about Roads to Joy. yeah, and I think although Connor often writes from the perspective of like drugs, alcohol, that kind of thing, you know, like you said, addiction can take its way in so many different forms, and it doesn't even have to be addiction. It could just be a bad habit that everyone has. So there is universality to be found with it. Now, something curious. So I love Road to Joy. This isn't a segue. I mean, it is also a segue, but it's not a clever one. I do really love Road to Joy, but sometimes after hearing Poison Oak, I am spent. I'm exhausted. And I feel like it should end the album sometimes, but it's not necessarily the way Connor and Mike and, you know, that now Nate, like the band has ended albums. They rarely end it on that kind of that type of song, right? Like I think of Ladder Song that goes into One For You, One For Me, like kind of like you've mentioned before, how they always like to end on some air of positivity. And even if Road to Joy isn't a positive song, it is leagues different from what Poison Oak is, right?
Right,
like,
right.
It is very Ladder Song-esque. I don't know. I guess it would be hard for me to imagine people's key ending on Ladder Song. But at the same time, like I said, I'm spent after hearing the song. It's hard for me to then get reinvigorated for Road to Joy. But at the same time, it makes some sense not to end the album overall. In Poison
Oak. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It's hard. Making an album is hard. Understatement of the year.
Well, that'll be on a t-shirt.
Yeah, right?
Making albums is hard. Just like a black t-shirt with that in white text.
Yeah. Times New Roman, size 12.
I kind of want to do that now. I mean, I feel like I can't keep doing this thing where it's like, yeah, Chris, technically we're the same person from alternate timelines. Because yeah, in many ways I feel like, okay, all right, if you want an excuse to string me up march me up to the gallows, I will say that Road to Joy is probably the only song I skip on this album.
Spicy.
Yeah, yep. I personally, most listens through this album, I end at Poison Oak.
Yeah, it's hard.
I think that I only slightly disagree with you in that I don't think that this is the kind of song that a Bright Eyes album usually ends with. Okay. But The Sound of Loneliness Makes Me Happier is kind of the exact bittersweet sentiment that I could expect from the end
of the Bright Eyes album. Yeah.
You know? And Road to Joy, maybe it's just that, like, it's not quite a cover song. But the fact that it, like, heavily samples a different song never really felt right to me. I don't know. It just, it's a strange song. And it is sort of, as you're saying, it's hard to go from Poison Oak to Road to Joy.
Yeah, I think Road to Joy has to exist in the context of this album.
Yes.
But I just don't know where I would place it. You know what I mean? Like, because I think this is meant to wrap up this kind of half social commentary, half this is my time in New York. Like, you're right. This feels more let's not shit ourselves than it does an album that has spent way more time focused on personal relationships in New York than it does the entire social commentary kind of thing.
Would it be outlandish to say that maybe this song would have been good as like a two-song EP with When the President Talks to God?
Maybe a little outlandish for my tastes. Maybe a little bit. I would be curious, like, to make a playlist with Landlocked Blues, Road to Joy, Poison Oak, and listen through this album a few times and then see, like, what happens, like, how I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? Let me get Connor on the horn real quick.
Oh, okay. All right. Wait, when did you get his number?
Hey, Coco, what's up, buddy? Yeah, no, we're just recording. The podcast. Yeah, right. Yeah, of course, you know about it. Yeah. No way. $100 patron? Dude, that's too nice. What are you saying? Okay, Connor says that if you're listening right now, you should be a patron. And if you're not, then, you know, go. I can't say that in the podcast. Anyway, so Jesse and I, you remember Jesse. Yeah, that Jesse.
Did you tell him I said hi?
Yeah. Anyway, no, don't worry about it. Yeah.
Wait,
no,
he's doing that thing again.
He's doing that thing again. Anyway, so
I'm waiting on his autograph. I sent him a couple of EPs to sign, and I never got it back.
Hey, hold on, Coco, one sec. Hey, we're trying to have a conversation right now. If you could just this is an A B conversation. Okay, I'm done. So let's talk about Road to Joy. After spending 5 minutes shitting on the existence of this song, let's talk about it. So I think, you know, it is very much more in the at the bottom of everything type vein. A song about the like hypocrisies, the inconsistencies of the world. I did think a lot about the opening and closing lines, right? Sun came up with no conclusions, flowers sleeping in their bed. So I was thinking about it in the way of like, so if we're thinking of sun as like some kind of like positive feeling, right? Like happiness, whatever it might be, light, positivity, whatever. It came up, but nothing changed, right? Like it's still dark out to the rest of the world. The flowers are still sleeping in their bed because the world is ignoring maybe some of that positivity because it's like it doesn't even feel like it exists sometimes. I don't know. I didn't really say that very eloquently, but I think you kind of know what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah, I think it maybe if we go back to that whole concept of disconnect, like ironically in real life, there is no pathetic fallacy where, like I said previously, like, yeah, you can be sad on a sunny day. Like,
right. Or there could be rain on your wedding day. Isn't right. that ironic?
But like the idea that you could wake up to a world that is indifferent to human emotion and as somebody who sees the world with an artistic eye, that can maybe be disturbing or put you in a distressed state, right? Like, there is nothing that suggests that the sun rising and things being as they are is somehow important to what's personally going on in your life. And yet, if you live your life as an artist and as somebody who crafts stories, that could leave you feeling a little empty.
Yeah. No, I think, thank you, because again, I feel like I come up with some ideas, but you just are much more better at doing the word talking. So I appreciate that. No, I agree, because you just said what I said, but better. And I'm not saying you stole what I said. You know what I'm trying to say. How dare you, Jesse?
See, my job in the podcast is to repeat back what Chris says, but with more better words.
Yep, that's stuff. Hey, you said it, not me.
Yeah, exactly.
So, really kind of the only other thing that I mean, I guess a couple of things, but they're small. So I wanted to bring up the telephone to talk to strangers, machine guns, and the camera lens. Because again, I think those are three, like a very pointed reference of, you know, we've invented ways to connect with people in ways never before believed. You know, the telephone, what the hell? You can communicate with someone else with that also as a telephone. And, you know, now with the internet and everything like that. But despite all of these ways to be closer, to understand one another, we also invented machine guns to mow them down. And then that camera lens comes back. And I think, again, is a way of saying the distorted truth of it. So, you know, we're going to create these things, this camera that has such sanctity in trying to capture what is happening, our world, to relive, to view, to share, really. The camera is being used in this, I don't know, very, very sad way, I guess you could think of it. I know it's a simple word, but like, we have so much potential, and this is the best that we can do.
And I think those, it's a very interesting three, like, in inventions to lump together. And I'm curious whether the reference to the telephone is like much how you're saying how a camera can be used to twist a narrative. And, you know, you literally have it on camera, but the little nuances tell a completely different story than, you know, somebody else's angle. And I'm curious if Connor, whether intentionally or accidentally, was referencing like a game of telephone.
Oh.
Is the news essentially a grown-up, very complicated version of a game of telephone?
Yeah.
And then you add guns and violence and it only gets messier.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, like you said, that's, I feel like it must be a pointed idea of like why these three inventions, not anything else. Like, you know, he could have said the internet, right? But he specifically chose the telephone, because believe it or not, kids, the internet was around in 2005. So I guess my overall thought on this song, then, the album is meant to be kind of a rallying cry, and so too is this song. Right? We're going to make him goddamn certain how it's going to end. I think it's, again, he's saying two different things in the same line, because speaking from the point of view of, you know, red, white, and blue, red-blooded American, we're going to make them goddamn certain how it's going to end. But also, I think from Connor's perspective of this, I don't know how we got to this point. But let's all band together and let's show them how it's going to end. And it's going to, you know, it's going to end in peace. But, you know, unfortunately, we have the burden of being able to look back on the past 15 years and Well, you know, you guys know.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. I don't know. Any last thoughts for Road to Joy?
I mean, I think that this is the, I'm surprised that nobody pointed out the, I could have been a famous singer if I had someone else's voice. But failures always sounded better. Let's fuck it up, boys. Make some noise.
I love it, dude. It is great.
It is great.
That and that performance, the live performance, and watching Nate destroy his trumpet.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
I tried to look into that a little bit. I tried to see if I could tease another meaning out of that. Like, is he saying that if he had Bob Dylan's voice, right, could he have been more famous? I thought of Bob Dylan specifically as a protest songwriter.
Huh.
I thought, yeah, right. And I thought of it because usually when I've heard it, I'm like, yeah, okay, he could have been a famous singer if he had this beautiful soaring voice. But I think there's also the other end of it too. Like, maybe if he was just a completely different person, I don't know. But again, I think that's just a way of me trying to read into this a little too much. Of like this protest song and album and things like that.
And I mean, to sort of like piggyback off of that too, I think it's probably also a little bit of if Conor Oberst had Justin Bieber's voice, would he still get picked up by the same people singing about, like, if he had sung anything from Fevers and Mirrors? Like, is he necessarily talking about his physical voice, or, you know, like the things that he's using his voice to say?
Yeah, right. Like, his narrative voice too.
Right. Like, if he had been, you know, more willing to sing, like if all of his songs were along the same lines of First Day of My Life, where they're really well written and sweet, but not that substantive, not that deep. Could have you gotten away with, like, you know, some more singles, some more, you know, popular exposure? But,
yeah,
you know, maybe better to have air quotes failed and given us something worth making a podcast over.
Oh, too true. Too true. Honestly, I think that sounds like a great way to kind of sum things up as well, right? Like, he's our guy, you know?
He's our mans.
He's our dude, man. He's our guy, bro. No, I don't know. It is I gained a different appreciation for the album. I still do feel as more connected to maybe some other albums in the discography. But there is a lot packed in here. I think when you look at maybe some of the symbolism that comes through, this could be Conor at his most vulnerable, because there is a very limited amount that is obscured behind additional layers of metaphor and things like that. It is probably the most clear album in terms of what's going on, which is interesting given that the weird psycho fuck trip that is Casadega would be the next thing to happen. But that's something to look forward to for a different episode.
Oh yeah, I can't wait to dig into that W.B. Yeats imagery that we're gonna explore. Reader, oh man, that's bad. Listener, if you don't know the works of William Butler Yeats, you'll be very familiar by next episode.
I think you got the next one by yourself. You're good. I don't like to learn things, so. Yeah, stay tuned so you learn my spa score on Casadega.
Yeah.
Here's the previous albums. 5 for Letting Off the Happiness.
Okay.
6.2 for Fevers and Mirrors. 5.6 for Lifted. 5.7 for Digital Ash. And 5.1 for I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning.
Interesting.
That's, yeah. I don't know. I'm not saying this is the end all be all, like it's properly tuned. It does kind of relatively fit with, I guess, what I would say in terms of those being in a relatively safe order of which albums I like more than others. But yeah. Calculate your SPA score.
Yeah. Don't tweet at us because we don't pay attention to that. But
we do not.
comment on the Instagram post when we make it for this episode.
SPA. All right. Slaps per album. That's it. That's the metric. And slaps per episode, 150.
So thanks so much for joining us on this journey through the probably the best known Bright Eyes album that they put out. So we hope we did it justice. We're curious to see what you folks think, but thanks for joining us on this journey. We hope to see you next time.
Hello again, and thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. It was a long one, but we just wanted to deliver so much content to make up for our radio silence over the last little while. That, and of course, we had so much to say on such a storied and magnificent album. Just like at the beginning of the podcast, wanted to thank everyone that has supported us on Patreon over the past little while we haven't been releasing episodes as regularly. So going through the list, thank you so much, Julia, Craig, Steven, Eric, Mom, Goldie, Lad. Can't tell you how much it means to us that you would support us in this way. That's all for us. Catch us next time. We'll be talking about the Four Winds EP leading up to Casadega, which, as Jesse just alluded to, he'll have quite a bit to say on.